the 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. We're running 6-7 minutes behind time, so I'll just say a quick word about the session, and that is that in a way, one of the key themes of the conference, but also the period we're in, has to do with learning the lessons of 2 years of having a go at scaling up. And we're quite fortunate that the session is being moderated by Jim Kim, who many of you will remember as the man behind 3x5. And if there was one person who could give an overview of scale up, it seems. Jim is no longer with the WHO as its director, and is now professor of the Francois Xavier Vigneault Professor of Health and Human Rights at Harvard University. So I'll give him 10 minutes to speak to you on the subject. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. We've got a really wonderful group of speakers, so I'll keep my remarks very brief, but would like to go over some points that that Paul Farmer and I recently made in an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it reflects my current thinking, our current thinking, on what is needed to take us to the next stage. First of all, just a couple of really quick points that we need to make. First of all, lots of things are working. There are such hugely varying approaches to treatment scale-up, and a lot of them seem to be working, that there are approaches that are very hospital-based. There are approaches that are very community-based. And in lots of different settings, these things are working. You have to remember that in December of 2003, when we launched the 3x5 movement, there were only 3 countries in the world that had even a plan for scaling up antiretroviral therapy, and there were just a very small number who had actually done anything about it. When Dr. Lee Jong-wook, who tragically passed away just a few months ago, when he took office, there were about 300,000 people on treatment. So that's clear. Lots of things are working in lots of places. But I think as we look forward, there are some really critical issues that we have to tackle right now. The first is that we have to have all first and second line drugs available at quote unquote Clinton prices as soon as possible. Now, I visited China and India, and I visited China and India with staff from WHO when I was still at WHO. And also one of the people who worked for me at WHO, Eloando Santos Pinheiro, who was the moving force behind the Farmaginos plant in Brazil that made the antiretrovirals in Brazil. When we went and visited those factories, what they told us was that they could make all first and second line drugs. They could make any drug except the fusion inhibitors at a price that was fairly close to the current Clinton price. In other words, a full range of available medicines could be made available for around $150 to maybe $300 or $400 per person per year, that we wouldn't have to pay the huge $3,000 and $4,000at this point in a lot of places, and even more, prices for second-line drugs that we're paying. What they told me was that the one thing that was holding them up was that their own government was hesitant to move forward and declare that they would use the full flexibility of the TRIPS agreement. And when I tried to find out why that was, it was difficult to find out. Let me just make one observation. Pharma, the research-based pharmaceutical industry, and it would be a reasonable exercise to count this up. I think that they have made by far the largest contribution to problems of poor people of any industry. I mean, compare them to Coke, to the clothing industry. In terms of industry per industry, they've made a huge investment. And under intense pressure from activists and others, in the end, they've given over either voluntary licenses or stopped fighting the various activities of the Indian manufacturers. But my sense is that they've always been about 6 months or a year late. And if they'd acted more quickly, they would have gotten the full benefit of the public relations that would come out saying, wow, you know, without even forcing you to do these things, you came out and you did the right thing. They have done the right thing a lot, I have to say, and I've worked with them a lot. But I wish right now, tomorrow, that they would stand up and say, full and open voluntary license for everyone. We don't want to be a hindrance. Tomorrow, we're going to start moving toward finding a way to get quality, low-cost first and second-line drugs to everybody in the world. We'll do whatever it takes to get us there. That's what we need them to do. And if they do it, I count on all of you to appropriately applaud them for doing that. And I would just make a plea that you've been 6 months to a year late every single time. Don't do it this time. One of the things we know is that, and it's just a refrain, health systems development has to be a part of HIV treatment scale-up. If you'll remember, as recently as 2003, the problem with infrastructure in developing countries was a conversation stopper. Oh, there's no infrastructure, you can't possibly scale up treatment. Well, what we now know is that even in terrible situations where health systems are falling apart, somehow we've managed to deliver the drugs. But that's not enough. We have to now focus on developing those systems using HIV treatment as a leading edge. I started out working on multidrug-resistant TB, not because we are so committed at Partners in Health to multidrug-resistant TB, because it was the right battle horse, as we call it. It was the right thing to lead with because it was a complicated treatment requiring expansion of all kinds of services that scared rich people. HIV treatment has been that for us. For some reason, the most powerful people in the world have gotten behind it. But now the task is to use HIV treatment, the interest around HIV treatment, to build health systems. Let me give you one example of a way that a particular organization that I work with, the Clinton HIV/AIDS Initiative, has been doing that. In Kenya, as you know, there's a problem with hiring, and many of you know anyway, there's a problem with hiring nurses. So the Clinton Initiative is going to hire those nurses because the government can't do it, and then over time, integrate them back into the healthcare system. So all of us should be thinking in the back of our heads, how do we build public health systems? Because it's the public that is going to be the public system that's going to be the only system over time that can assure the right to health. Now, the NGO work is fantastic, but over time we've got to build those public systems. There's a lot of work on community health workers, but you know, I think an indication of the great advances we've made, and even in the last 2 years, is that the most radical thing I've seen during the big plenary sessions is, open your purses, we need more nurses. You know, that's not all that radical. It's not shame, it's not throwing things. I mean, we have advanced so far that we've gotten to the nitty-gritty issues of health workers, but we do need a lot more money for health workers. The only short-term response to scaling up treatment is to decentralize and to task shift so that nurses and health workers can do more of what we need done. At Partners in Health, one of the most important things that we have emphasized is that HIV treatment can't be done without full, what we call wraparound services, food, housing, and at times employment for those who can work. In scaling up HIV treatment in the Central Plateau of Haiti, the most common technique we use is to open up a clinic and provide primary care services. That way, people who are sick from other things and who may be living with HIV/AIDS and not doing well are coming to a relatively unstigmatized environment because it's a general primary health care clinic, getting tested and getting access to services. In those situations, what we know again and again and again is that the critical thing is not to try to figure out how to deliver ARV therapy in the midst of total chaos, constant human rights abuses, and forget about all the other things. We have to deliver all those other things together, food, primary care services, those things have to go with HIV treatment. And more we're seeing that happening. We also need more money. There's no question that we need more money. And the only thing I'll leave you with, those of you who are not from North America, is that since the beginning of conflict, we've spent more than $400 billion on Iraq and Afghanistan. And we spend every year more than $450 billion on defense, not counting Iraq and Afghanistan. Some of the activists are calling for a $650 million plan for health workers. That's about 2 days of work, 2 days of spending in Iraq. So why don't we take a two-day war holiday and fund health workers? Finally, let me talk about human rights a bit. When you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it doesn't say, and every person should have the right not to know their HIV status so they won't be stigmatized. In fact, the Human Rights Declaration says people have access to health and food and education and safety. The most appropriate human rights approach today is to implement HIV treatment that includes primary care, that includes protection of children, that includes food, every place in the world. The rights-based approach is to break the implementation bottleneck and get to universal access as quickly as we possibly can. Thank you.
So, if I were with the local airline, I'd be saying, if Dorothy Odhiambo and Agnes Binagwaho don't make their way now to the front desk, your bags will be taken out of the hold. So we're missing two speakers, and that's a pity, because to get a real feeling for what has happened over the last 2 years, you know, we were hoping to present you with five cases and then for Jim to do the overall thing, and then the discussion can be enriched. I think we're only going to have three case studies. I guess we can allow another 2 or 3 minutes per speaker. But I'll leave the police keeping with you, Jim. So our next speaker is Richard Stern, who's going to speak to us about the experience with scaling up in Costa Rica. Richard is director of the Agua Bueno Foundation a well-known activist for treatment and scale-up. So we'll give you, I think, 12 minutes, Richard, and look forward to your presentation. If you better start right away.
Okay, don't want to miss a second. So I'm glad to be here at IAS, which I believe has probably the largest private police force in Canada at the moment, making sure that all of the activists behave ourselves. I'm going to talk about Central America, and what I put up to begin with, Central America now has 50 to 60% antiretroviral access coverage in 7 countries. These are the 7 countries. And mainly El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua are very close to the low end of middle income countries as far as the UNDP Human Development Index. One of the implications of this is that they're always considered middle income countries when it comes to pricing discounts, but they're really very, very little above some of the African countries that are eligible for these pricing discounts. And in terms of the populations of the countries and when antiretroviral access was made available, you can see that this chart basically shows the current panorama. I'm just going to let people look at it very quickly. We're stuck with inadequate surveillance systems in terms of knowing if these numbers are really accurate. But as you can see in, for example, Guatemala, an estimated 5,500 people need treatment access, and about 5,000 people have it. And at the moment, the Global Fund is supporting 1,000 people. There's a controversy in El Salvador about how many people need treatment access, because the National AIDS Director says that there's 100% access. And we say that there's 2,000 people who need treatment based on WHO estimates and some anecdotal studies that we've done ourselves. And in terms of the situation in Nicaragua, there's practically no accurate HIV surveillance, which is a pity, because when we're talking about universal access and scaling up, if we don't know how many people have treatment and how many, well, how many people need treatment and where they're located, it's very hard to figure out exactly what you need. So there are disputes about the figures. Okay, I just talked about that. The first attempt, and it was a successful attempt at scaling up in Central America, was in fact in Costa Rica, where I was living at the time, continued to live there, in 1996, when people from Costa Rica heard about the existence of antiretroviral medications and have a universal healthcare system in that country. There was an informal coalition formed. People were really pessimistic because the cost was over $10,000 per year at that time, but they formed an informal coalition, and the coalition attempted to negotiate with the national health care system, which covers the entire population. To summarize very rapidly, the national health care system did not negotiate in good faith, but kept promising next month we'll do something, in 3 months we're going to start a pilot project, whatever. They called in a high-priced consultant from one of these international agencies who did a study that said that the national healthcare system would be bankrupt by the year 2001 if they provided universal access due to the prices. Later on, about 3 years later, he admitted that he had committed the error of basing his calculations on African-style figures, which was a rather serious error since his report was published in all the daily papers and used by the government as ammunition to say that people didn't need, that the system would be unable to afford treatment. But when the case was taken to the Supreme Court by William Garcia, Guillermo Morillo, and a couple of other people living with AIDS, the judges of the Supreme Court, and it is an independent judiciary, unlike some countries, did rule in favor of people living with AIDS and ordered the healthcare system to immediately begin providing antiretroviral access, which at that time meant that they literally went out to the pharmaceutical companies, sent someone over to buy the medications because they had to provide them within 48 hours. To make a long story short, by the end of December of 1997, there were 300 people on treatment, and now there's roughly 2,300 people on treatment. There have been very few treatment interruptions, but if there was a lesson to be learned, it was this was a grassroots group of people with absolutely no financial support. There were no divisions. There was no one fighting over the money from the Global Fund. It was simply a group of people that wanted and needed to survive. There was no hierarchy even of people living with AIDS at that point. Everybody was in the same desperate situation. It was interesting to see at one point how transgendered people were in the room, and some people, working people who were hemophiliacs, came in and sort of looked shocked to see who they would be sitting next to and working with. But then within about 10 minutes, everybody was working together because everybody wanted to survive. I'm not saying the existence of resources is bad. I'm saying that we had some very pure activism and a very united group of people in Costa Rica. And so that this was an extremely successful action, and probably Costa Rica is still one of four or five countries in Latin America that has universal access. Following the situation in Costa Rica, I myself had been publishing some information over the internet, and then I was asked to go to Panama, and I began to meet with people in Panama, especially a couple, Dr. Orlando Quintero. He's a publicly identified person living with AIDS, And they tried the same route of going to the Supreme Court initially. But the court, after about several months, returned the case and said, no, you didn't file the papers. You don't have the right approvals from, you know, the different district courts, etc. And so then what happened was very simple. People didn't accept that. Panama is also a relatively wealthy country with a social security system that's supposed to provide for its membership, who are people who pay into it. It doesn't cover the entire country. It covers only 20 to 25% of the population. But they held a demonstration in front of the social security system. They chained themselves to the doors. They blocked the main street. They got a lot of good attention in the press. It was a courageous group of only about really 10 or 12 people that did that. And about a week later, the board of directors of the semi-private but still national health care insurance program agreed to provide antiretroviral medications. And again, at a time when this did not even exist, later it became, or at the time it had become, ProBidCita, a very small NGO, again, without any financial support. Unfortunately, the divided healthcare system in Panama leaves out about 70% of the population, and there is, classism in the sense that that 70% are poor people, migrant workers, agricultural workers, street vendors, and as we've seen in many countries, there's a hierarchy, not stated, never publicly stated, and politically incorrect to talk about it, and politically incorrect to say that some PLWA, when they get treatment themselves, I'm not necessarily talking about Panamanians, but that they're not as interested in the poorest and most marginalized people who live in rural areas, and that's sort of what happened in Panama, where it took another couple of years before the health ministry began to provide treatment to these kinds of isolated and marginalized people who could not afford to pay in to the semi-private national health care program. I'm going to skip over Honduras, which is a very dramatic case, again with demonstrations, again with no funding, and move on to lessons learned and conclusions. And as I've more or less stated, I call this a kind of pure activism. This resulted really in ARV access for a relatively small number of people, but set important precedences in each country. What we've learned is that if once some people are on treatment that's being provided by the government, not necessarily by NGOs, other people will get upset, will get motivated, and will take on a more activist or a proactive role in terms of their own treatment. And it was kind of the golden years in some ways. We didn't have any financing, and neither did anybody else, but so much got done in Central America in terms of pressuring governments, demonstrations, people lying down in the street, people demonstrating outside the Congress, cases being filed with the Inter-American Human Rights Commission in Washington, such as in El Salvador in 1999, and then 2 years later in three other Central American countries. The arrival of the Global Fund in late 2002, beginning with Honduras, opened the doors for greater access. And we're glad the Global Fund is there, but at the same time, previously militant NGOs have been faced with the possibility of large disbursements of cash from the Global Fund, which unfortunately creates conflicts, leads to manipulation by the more powerful members of these CCMs, who are usually from the government sector, and tends to condition financing, and NGOs become divided and fearful, and in some cases the battle becomes more over who's going to get the funding than over how to get the treatment. And then we have the problem of the Global Fund delays in the rollout of treatment. I can't get into detail in this at the moment, but maybe during the question and answer session, in the sense that this is very important, that the Global Fund is country-driven, that we have a situation, for example, in Guatemala, where it took one full year, for the principal recipient, World Vision, to do procurement, to begin to provide the first antiretrovirals with hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars they had available, and it shouldn't take that long. And the Global Fund is a little bit too country-driven and doesn't intervene adequately in crisis situations, so taking a year is too long. And perhaps my final point is the crisis that we're facing now is the fact that the dramatic drop in prices and, unfortunately, as Jim was referring to also, the prices are now rising. Rescue therapy, even with supposedly some new price reductions from Abbott, is completely out of the question in most countries. In Honduras, for example, 30% of the entire global fund budget is taken up just buying Choletra, and that's for 300 people out of 3,500, and that's been the situation that's typical across the region as the prices, instead of continuing to drop, start to rise. And I'll stop there.
Well, thank you, Richard. Having heard about treatment scale-up in Latin America in the kind of low prevalence setting, it's going to be a bit of a switch now to go to Malawi and hear about kind of a pretty successful scale-up from an enrollment point of view in that country. And we're very lucky to have the government official, the head of the rollout program, to describe what has gone before over the last 2 years. Our next speaker is Simon Makombe. He is the ARV officer in the government of Malawi and has been responsible for the ARV scale-up. And I'll call on him to speak to you for 10 or 12 minutes.
Good afternoon. I'm going to present to you the national scaling up which we undertook in Malawi. But before I do that, let me just give you a background. Okay. Let me just give you a background of how the situation is in Malawi. It's a population of 11.5 million people with a GDP of $200 per capita. It's a country which is heavily infected with HIV. At the moment, we estimate that there are 900,000 people living with the infection, and the 170,000 people need the ART at the moment. In 2004, there were only 4,000 people on ART in 9 sites without any standardization of treatment. But it was soon after the 2000, the World AIDS Conference in Durban, that most African countries in sub-Saharan Africa started thinking of scaling up ART. And these are the steps which the country took. A political commitment in 2000 after the meeting, they had a press conference of the Vice President. We decided to follow the DOST system. 2002, we had the Global Fund, and we developed the National ARV Guidelines and the National Scale-Up Plan. At first, the country wanted to have a medicalized model in which only doctors should deliver ARVs, choice of multiple ARV regimens, and mandatory laboratory tests, and to have computerized the system of tracking patients. We felt that this will preclude rapid, massive, and scale. So we decided that we should keep this simple and standardized. And this was the 2-year plan, that is 60 facilities were selected for treatment, and all the sites were supposed to give free ART to HIV positive patients, first line treatment only, push system for ordering drugs, standardized system for monitoring and reporting, and quarterly structured supervision. I want to follow this schedule. Even we classified the institutions into low bedding, medium, and high bedding. Low bedding, including 25 patients per month, 50 patients per month, medium bedding, and 150 patients, new patients per month, high bedding. And administration only looked at those with the HIV positive test, understanding implications of ART, those in WHO clinical stage 3 or 4, those with the CD4 count below the threshold value. I want to go through this one. And this was what we suggested, that it should be a nurse-led clinic. A clinician could only see a patient in 3 months, or unless there's a patient, there's a problem. Patients weighed and screened with a symptom-based inquiry. Then drugs to be dispensed in the ART clinic. This is their registration and monitoring. And these are the monitoring tools. And this is the data collection. And this is the progress which has been made since 2003 in December up to December 2005. You can see that there were only 3,000 to 4,000 estimated patients on the ARV. And by December 2005, 60 sites and 37,840 patients had ever started ARV. And we have a vision, and this vision is in line with what we want to achieve with the universal access to ART. We have a 5-year plan, and we have posted the first two years, and we will require $47 million United States dollars in order to do that. And our goal is to achieve 50% of universal access. That is putting 45,000 patients on ART per year. And this is the roadmap. You can see that we are at 37,840 now, and by 2010 we want a cumulative figure of 245,000 patients on treatment. But we have challenges in order to achieve this. Human resource, it's a problem, physical infrastructure, the rooms which were there enough for the patients we started with are no longer able to accommodate the number of patients. The pharmacies are small. Are we going to have an interpreted drug supply, adequate finances, integrity of the first-line regimen? We have already started seeing drug resistance and the long-term side effects. But we will still maintain that the key will be maintain simplicity, because we don't want to complicate matters, otherwise we can scale up. We will simplify the registration and monitoring system. At least reduce the patient visits to 2 or every 3 months. Decentralize the ART delivery, bringing the services closer to the people, to the health centers and beyond, and allow lower cadre managers to deliver ART. That is, nurses, medical assistants can enroll and follow up patients. And the community home-based care volunteers, people living with AIDS, community-based organization volunteers to be involved in issues of follow-up, adherence, counseling, and referral. Okay. Thank you very much for your attention. That was the end of my presentation.
Would you like to do another presentation, Simon? You've got lots of time.
We've got time left. This is the first time ever. Unless our other speakers show up, our final speaker, and then we'll have plenty of time to discuss these really fascinating presentations. I think we're going to see an interesting contrast here. Dr. Fareed Abdullah is currently Director of Technical Support of the International HIV-AIDS Alliance, and he's based in the United Kingdom. But I met him when he was the Deputy Director General of Health in the Western Cape Province, getting himself into trouble almost every day, pushing forward HIV treatment access in that place. I met him first in Khayelitsha, right outside of Cape Town. And he has been a real hero in scaling up treatment. And one of the things that the people at MSF who work closely with him have told me again and again is that if it weren't for Dr. Fareed Abdullah paving the way for their work, they never would have been able to reach the numbers and the scale that they did. And he worked with them on a daily basis to make sure that drug procurement, supply chain management was streamlined. So I, first of all, thank Dr. Abdullah for all that he's done, and we look forward to your comments.
I had to pay a large amount of money to Jim to say something like that. I want to make 3 points. I have lots of slides and I'll go through them quickly, but there are 3 points. One is to try to make a description of what's happened in South Africa over the last 2 years. And you know, my main experience has been in the Western Cape, but there hasn't been time to put that detail in this presentation. And then a quick point about one or two of the financing issues. And then I want to make my third point, which is that we have to look at the delivery model for healthcare if we want to really go to higher levels of scale up. And I'm quite pleased that I'm going after Simon because, you know, in a way, it's taken us such a long time to realize, you know, that that's the kind of direction that we should be thinking of going in. And I know there are lots of people smiling in this room because I've resisted that for a long time and have slowly come around to that view. Anyway, having said that, this is a description of what has happened in South Africa over the last 2 years in the public sector. And the main number you want to focus on is 140,000. Now, in South Africa, you always have another view, so let's look at what the civil society estimate is for scale-up. March is missing because there was a big protest march, so they couldn't collect the data. But the point is that more or less, you know, there is agreement that the same, you know, around the same level of scale up. This next slide is the most studied estimation of the scale up in South Africa, and you know it's both a demographic model and being used as an estimation model. So what it does is it collects all the data available and plugs it into a model which then estimates what the coverage might be based on what the underlying understanding is of the need. And these estimates are around this was a March run of the ASSA 2003 model, so it's a few months behind. Estimates that about 220,000 patients are on treatment, and as many as 80 or 90,000 on treatment in the private sector. So these numbers kind of align up reasonably well. Using the same estimation model, we can see the distribution of scale-up across 9 provinces. And 2 provinces kind of stand out, the Western Cape with a higher level and Gauteng. We never really kind of look at the numbers for the Northern Cape because it's such a small population. So in summary, after 2 years of scale-up, it can be reasonably certain that there are about 250,000 people on treatment in South Africa, and that represents around 25% of those in need of treatment. And I should say that you know that's simply put, but actually it has to do with the numerator has to do with the number of people moving in from stage 3 to stage 4 over a period of time. So this is not, you know, kind of to be understood in a linear way. It's a dynamic model, but it does give you a feeling for the level of coverage. And clearly, South Africa now is the largest program in the world. I wouldn't rush to say it's the best program in the world, but certainly it's the largest from an absolute numbers point of view. When one province has been able to achieve a much higher level of coverage, South Africa is enrolling about 10,000 patients each month onto treatment. and the treatment is widely available in 170 municipalities. In one province, we've had data, clinical outcomes data for over a four-year period, and looking at a cohort of just over 12,000 patients in that province, you know, we're already able to see that there's a reasonably high, a good quality of programming possible in this kind of context, in the South African context, with 75% of patients retained in care after 48 months, a very high level of viral suppression measured by viral load over that same period of time, and a significant reduction in the ultra-sick who were always at the front of the queue, showing a reduced mortality at 6 months over the last year compared to the first year in treatment. So those are some quality. I had more data on this, but Jim wouldn't let me show them to you. So I guess, in summary, scale-up, meaning a protocol-driven public health approach, has resulted in significant scale-up with good quality clinical outcomes at an affordable level. And let me just talk about the affordability for the next two or three slides. You know, the idea of these presentations is just to pick out the four or five main points so we can have a good discussion about it in after the presentation. But quickly, South Africa is basically funding the lion's share of funding for the ART scale-up comes from local sources, from government funding. And, you know, it's a small proportion of the kind of public sector health spending that goes to ART. That I found quite an instructive number, that less than 5% of the public sector health budget, that ART costs less than 5% of the public sector health budget. And in fact, the true figure is closer to 4%, and that's just measuring what comes through conditional grants. And to give you a bit of a feeling for the health spending generally in the country, the total budget in rands is 51 billion rand, or 10% of public sector spending, and only 3% of GDP spending. Significantly, provinces are contributing about one-third of the spending on HIV in general, but ARTS specifically. There are two funding issues which need to be resolved to bring the costs down lower, to limit costs with further scale-up, and I'm very optimistic that these will be easily solved in the South African setting. The first is a mismatch between the resource allocation formula that allocates funding for ART between provinces, and the basic mismatch is between the funding levels and the level of scale-up, with three provinces having to add make additional contributions to the ART budget. And I guess, if you want to call it, there's an inefficiency in the financing system in that provinces which are not scaling up on the same level, you know, are likely diverting funds to other line items, and that detracts from the overall aim of a targeted funding strategy which South Africa has for ART. The second issue has to do with the price of drugs, and now there are inefficiencies here which need to be more aggressively addressed. And they're simple things to get done right, and they're not difficult from a kind of global pricing structure or trade point of view. And those have to do with the price of first line drugs, which can be brought down significantly in the case of first line with efavirenz. And South African doctors really seem to like efavirenz a lot. Just the registration of a generic efavirenz will bring down the price substantially. In fact, my own back of the cigarette box calculations are that the registration of a generic efavirenz could bring down the bill for drugs in a program as big as this by as much as 20%, allowing many thousands more places for treatment in the same financing envelope. And we know that fixed dose combinations, first line fixed dose combinations, are available at certainly, you know, $150 and even less than that. Similar problems exist with the second line treatment, where second line is, you know, almost five times more expensive than first line treatment. And in the cohort that we're able to follow up in the Western Cape, as many as 17 or 18% of people, you know, will be on second line after 4 years. So it's a reasonable estimate that about 20% of patients are going to need second line treatment, you know, after 5 years of scale up, which makes the whole pricing issue around second line drugs pretty urgent in this kind of period of scale up. And I was really glad for your comments, Jim, on this. I think that we need a second wave, you know, of the MSF's Access to Intentional Medicines campaign, together with the Clinton Foundation initiatives, to dramatically, you know, address this issue. But once again, I'm pretty optimistic about the price of second-line drugs coming down. And the same applies to syrups for children and fixed-dose combination drugs for children. And I guess for South Africa, this removes the last cost barrier to full scale-up. Coming back to this slide and using it to make an hypothesis that scale-up, you know, is critically dependent on the model of healthcare delivery. Apart from, you know, the key issues which we've heard so much about, strengthening health systems, the human resource needs, drug pricing, the right kind of policies and leadership that's needed, senior and middle management challenges in the developing world, in sub-Saharan Africa, in South Africa certainly. Apart from those things, we think that the single obstacle in a country like South Africa is going to be the model of healthcare delivery. In the case of at least seven of the provinces, the basic delivery model is to deliver out from large hospitals where the expertise exists, and we think that these hospitals will now reach a saturation point, and that this model can take you up to a 20 or 25% level of coverage for ART. These are four hospitals from another province, and just to show you that hospitals are reaching, you know, 6,000, 7,000, or 8,000 patients, and we're now seeing, you know, big queues developing in the big hospitals. So that model is, you know, is going to certainly limit the ability to scale up to higher levels. In the Western Cape province, 60% of patients receive ART in a community health center setting. And clearly that's, you know, a big factor in being able to reach a higher level of scale up. And we see a similar trend in the Gauteng province, where over the recent period there's been, you know, roll out to smaller hospitals and community health centers. And I'm pretty sure that province will also go up to a 50 or 60% level. But the point we would like to make today is that to achieve universal access on a level of 80% coverage or higher, the health system and the ART delivery system has to engage a lower level of the health service. I think the presentation by Simon from Malawi is nothing short of radical, and I would be kind of quite afraid to go that far. But that's clearly in the direction in which we have to go. And there are two options in the South African context. One is to go to the PHC clinic level, and the other is to go to a large and ubiquitous network of private general practitioners where often there is little other health facility. But it's easier said than done, and some of the key, you know, points for discussion of putting art at the PHC clinic, at PHC clinic level. So there exists a vast network of PHC clinics throughout South Africa. In urban areas, there's often a visiting doctor from a community health center or district hospital. This model facilitates better integration with tuberculosis services, which in their own are seeing patients with a higher level of acuity, and that is tending to draw a higher skills level to the TB clinic. And there might be a confluence of need in combining art and ARV care. And I guess one has to start with the simple steps. And the first would be to refer down patients who are already on art and stable on first-line drugs to a nurse-based clinic. There's some experience now, and I think I was quite, once again, referring to the Malawi experience, pleased to see that it happened on a large scale. But on a smaller scale, there are few sites now which have got 2 or 3 years of experience with a largely nurse-run service with some kind of doctor support. And quite frankly, when there are no doctors, then you don't have any choices. So it's pretty straightforward. The decision making there is pretty straightforward. But there there will have to be certain key protocol changes with new technologies and lab access for CD4 counts, training, and then a separate pathway for the ultra sick patients with very low CD4 counts. For screening for OIs with a higher skills level being engaged and some kind of accreditation process. To illustrate the case, if we look at Khayelitsha, and in Khayelitsha, which Jim referred to earlier, the province had a really great support from Médecins Sans Frontières, and there were no real political or financial obstacles to scaling up. And Khayelitsha were able to attain a 45 or 50% level of coverage. And the basic problematic is a structural problem within the healthcare delivery model for art. And that is that the three large community health centers, which had 11 doctors doing art and six nurses, just couldn't cope with the numbers. And with the yellow line assuming that we could get 70% of people who need treatment onto treatment, each of these community health centers will have to have more than 5,000 patients in treatment, and that's just unsustainable. Whereas if we went to the remaining facilities in the Khayelitsha district and connected them in the right way, then it becomes a lot more possible to reach higher levels of scale-up. A quick few words on the private GPs. We have good data in South Africa from disease management programs as a kind of health insurance-based programs which use general practitioners to provide art care and monitor their care through intensive kind of information systems. It's a kind of remote management and monitoring. And, the Aid for AIDS program, for instance, has got 40,000 patients on treatment. So they're able to do this on a large scale. And I guess, particularly with rural areas where we have a large number of private general practitioners, this is an option which has to be very seriously considered. In South Africa, in a place like South Africa, there shouldn't be a doctor, a general practitioner who's not treating patients for art. And my guess is that we must have 40 or 50% of our doctors who are not treating patients for art. And in rural areas particularly, there's a lack of doctors in the public sector outside the big towns. And clinics, have a long way to go before kind of getting up to the level of their kind of urban counterparts. So in conclusion, South Africa could be said to be on track for reaching about half the number of people who need treatment in the current models. New models of art delivery that engage nurses in PHC clinics and private GPs will facilitate further scale-up.
and the achievement of universal access. I'd just like to acknowledge the following people who, you know, who discussed many of these issues with me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, unfortunately, since the other speakers haven't come, well, unfortunately, we don't have them, but we've got some time. And we're getting to the end of the meeting, so I invite anyone to come with questions. Would love to hear of other experiences as well. Why don't we start? Is that Mandeep in the back? Go ahead.
Hi, Jim. I'd like to thank the presenters for a really rich diversity of presentations. A couple of comments. First question for the colleague from Malawi. Could you tell us a little bit about the investments of bilaterals such as DFID in the health sector strengthening in scaling up the Malawi initiative? So, for example, their efforts to pay the salaries of health workers, which is not a common thing for bilaterals to do, and what effect that had. And the next two comments and questions, Jim, are for you. I was really pleased to hear you talk about the right to health and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I think I completely agree the right to health doesn't mean the right to die without knowing your status. But the right to health also means the right to autonomy and dignity. And there is no hierarchy of rights. And I wonder, there's been a lot of discussion about routine testing, and I'd like to hear your opinion on what you think people saying that actually, you know, doing away with consent and confidentiality is actually the right way to scale up. And in fact, if we create a hierarchy of rights, are we not abrogating rights and in the long term really damaging the response to HIV?
Okay, thank you very much for your question. What I can say is the contribution of the DFID to the national scale up is so enormous that the very shortly, they decided to contribute funding so that the government can retain its staff and all the all the health workers in the country have had a 52% increase on their salaries coming from DFID so that they can be retained in the system. And again, DFID is also supporting the country in the training institutions in order for the country to increase intake of medical doctors, nurses and clinical officers so that we can increase the number of health workers who are needed in order to respond to the health issues.
Let me take it, it's not a brief question, but Mandeep, let me just, I've been listening carefully to the debates over scaling up testing, and of course I've been involved with the project in Lesotho, the Know Your Status project. And let me put it this way: I think that in taking over the François Xavier Bagnou Center, what I did was I went back and looked really carefully at what Jonathan Mann, I think, was trying to get at when he introduced the whole concept of health and human rights. And I also talked to a lot of people that he worked with, including family members, including colleagues at that time. And my current understanding of what Jonathan, who was a hero of mine, and I'm sure a hero of many people here, was trying to do, was to do anything he could to be in solidarity with poor people, especially in Africa, living with HIV/AIDS. He was not a lawyer. He wasn't a scholar of health and human rights to begin with. But he thought that it was an extraordinarily effective tool to get this issue out. Now, I don't think, I mean, I have never written, and in fact have tried to emphasize that confidentiality and counseling are important. I don't think that we are ready to get rid of counseling. And I think that, especially in Lesotho and everywhere else, our strong, strong recommendation is that it is simply a increase in the offer of voluntary testing. But I tell you, in a place where some 30% of the adults are infected with HIV at the higher end of the estimates, I think there's just no question that we've got to figure out a way to get it done. Now, here's what I would say. I think Some of this debate reminds me of the debates that we had prior to acceptance of wide-scale treatment. Now, you have to remember, back in Bangkok, there was still a lot of argument about all the bad things that could happen if we started wide-scale treatment. There were people who said, you know, there will be no attention to prevention. Well, I think, you know, there's still, we need a lot more attention to prevention, but if you just look at dollar figures, there's so much more money and attention to prevention now in most places than there was prior to HIV treatment scale-up. I think there's a lot of things that we were afraid of that didn't happen. Now, again, I go back to this notion that there's no health infrastructure, so therefore we can't scale up treatment. That used to be a conversation stopper, and everybody would say, oh, of course, so let's just forget about it. Where I hope we've come in the discussion on testing is that all of these problems that are going to exist, we're going to have problems. We're going to have people who face terrible consequences upon disclosing their status or upon knowing their status. We know this is going to happen. But I haven't heard anyone say that we should then turn the clock back and not try to get more people to know their status and not try to get more people on therapy. So I see it this way. I see it that, you know, respecting all of these rights is really critical. But I fear that an overemphasis on the right not to know will inadvertently lead us to violating all kinds of other human rights. That's my concern. Not necessarily hierarchizing them, although I think, in my own personal view, that the right to live and not die of HIV/AIDS is the most important right. So I think that in 2 years, where we're going to be is that in a lot of places, we're going to come up with all kinds of interesting and important solutions to the problem of scaling up treatment, scaling up testing, respecting human rights, and getting people on therapy. And that's got to be the approach. Not ideological arguments, but a sort of putting your shoulder to the wheel and figuring out how to get this job done. Mic one.
I'm Mary Hadley. I'm working in Zambia with the Minister of Health. I've listened with great interest to these presentations. I'd like to hear a little bit about patients who are lost to follow-up. What we're finding now in Zambia, that while we are now providing ART in the health centres, in selected health centres in Copperbelt, for instance, we're finding the districts and the health centres have a natural responsibility for the population, the health of their population, and they have systems that they can use, for instance, through the TB system, through the TB control system, where they can follow up patients easily in the communities, whereas the major referral hospitals where most of the patients are being seen, they are just responsible for the patients that they see, the ones that are referred to them. The referral back to health centres is not that well developed. So we're actually finding less patients lost to follow-up in the health centres than actually in the hospitals. And I wonder if you have that same experience.
So we'll take three questions. Mic two.
Are you asking me to go ahead?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Good afternoon. My name is Mariam Kamara, and I'm from Guinea. And I wanted to have a question and make a comment. The first one is ask any one of you to answer what it is in your experience you had to look at when you were working with others in your respective countries in terms of designing a model that would increase access to ARVs. And I'm just asking that because there are people that, you know, I'm a pharmacist by training and I've worked 14 years in the U.S. And it seems to me that within our country, we're being told this is what has worked. You have to look at what has worked before and this is what's been working. So there's not enough room for creative processes so that you can contribute in any fashion and in ways you can. So that's my first question. And the comment I have would have to do with the fact that it's taking a little bit out of the context, but it seems to me that we focus a lot on increasing access to ARVs and funding. I want to know what your thoughts are in terms of the accountability of a lot of the people that are coming on behalf of different international groups into West Africa or Africa and any African countries that have consistently been spending a lot more money on housing expenses and SUVs and all of the things, and we see it every day in Africa.
Mike one.
Selena Shockin from the Center for Global Development. And I guess the question that came out from all the presentations is, what is the best model? Is there one model? Should there be multiple models? Because the Partners in Health model, which I was able to visit in Rwanda, is a very expensive model, and there's other expensive models, but it delivers a very high quality of care. And I'm wondering, especially for you, Jim, whether you would have supported the Partners in Health model for all programs when you were at the WHO, because it's very expensive and we're not going to be able to treat as many people for that model. Is there a point of studying cost effectiveness on treatment models?
Let's do one more. Mike, two.
Okay, thank you. My name is Andy Gaston. I work with the Livingstone Synod AIDS program in the north of Malawi. I'd first of all like to commend the HIV unit of the Ministry of Health in Malawi for an incredibly rapid scale-up. I think it's the single greatest change in Malawi and the HIV aid work that's finally given us something truly positive in positive living, and it's going to help us with encouraging people to be tested, behavior change, and so on. However, of course, there are concerns as we scale up. There's a concern I have over equity, that at present the drugs are being delivered through district hospitals and are not reaching the rural population. The majority of people being reached are those who are in urban areas. How do we address that equity? There's also a concern, obviously, that inadequate monitoring of patients through health centres may lead to ultimately to treatment failures, to increasing drug resistance. But also the further drugs are away from patients in rural areas, patients are going to default because of the enormous indirect costs and the opportunity costs of reaching treatment, which we hear from people in villages. So how are we going to address those issues around maintaining sort of quality? I mean, the current standards of care at health centres are, frankly, appalling in rural areas. So what plans are there? Can Simon discuss more about how the infrastructure of health centres will be improved, how this monitoring and delivery system at health centres is going to work? Thank you.
Thank you. Let's. I'll leave it open to the panelists. First question about being lost to follow up. You'd like to take that, Fareed, maybe?
I think the answer to that question was implied. A big hospital is no place to provide antiretroviral therapy. It's just wrong from so many points of view. And your point about patients being lost to follow up when they referred back to their first or second line facility is exactly right. That's been experienced all over. And I think what most a lot of places have done is to start where there was expertise. At the beginning there's a feeling that you've got a specialist physician or you want to get it going there. But I think one really wants to limit initiating patients onto treatment there. What we have learned about scale up even before the 3x5 period, in all the pilot work in the years before that, is that antiretroviral treatment is a primary care intervention, and the benefits of being close to the facility and being able to build adherence programs and drug literacy programs, far outweighed the kind of additional skills level that you might find in a hospital. So that's pretty kind of fun. And I guess when Jim came to Cape Town, he said, what's the most amazing thing about, what can you tell me about scale up? What did you learn about scale up? And I said, well, we couldn't believe how easy it was. Now, I'd like to modify that a bit. Because I think it's, it's easy from one point of view in that the first kind of phase, there is a unused capacity in the health service to absorb, numbers of patients. Data from the Western Cape on follow-up on a community level was also interesting. And that is that when you have low levels of uptake, 5 or 10% coverage, then loss to follow-up tends to be quite low. But when you get to the 50 or 60% level, even at the community level, then you can quite easily get 5 or 6% of patients being lost to follow-up. Now, that could be a kind of a result of... it could be a rollout phenomenon. Putting it simply, patients who might travel a bit further from their home to initiate treatment might then move closer to home when a new site opens. So that could be a bit of a rollout phenomenon with loss to follow-up. But I guess it's incontrovertible that the more patients you have, the bigger the size of your program, you know, you will lose patients to follow-up. And within that, the biggest worry are those who are dying and not being recorded.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me just add on the issue of patients who are lost to follow-up. The experience of Zambia is just the same as in Malawi. The reason is that the people are traveling for a long distance, and they cannot manage to do it every month to go to the central hospital or district hospital to collect drugs. It's the same. Difficult to follow up somebody who is coming from 50 kilometers away. But the health centers are close to the where these people are staying. Okay? And there are structures already existing in the community. We have community-based, community home-based care committees, community-based organizations, faith-based organizations. These have got a network which patients are linked to. Right, and their job is to follow up these people and report back what has happened to the patients. But for leader from district hospital, central hospital, to do a follow up, it's impossible. And on the issue of equity, my friend from Livingstonia, the push system which we are running in Malawi for delivering ARVs is not going through the DHOs. The drugs are going direct through the health center, which is on the list of the scale-up. So there's no issue of DHO holding drugs for the health center. ARVs will go direct to the health center without bypassing the district hospital. That's what the system is all about. Because we are aware of the consequences of other drugs which are going through the district hospital, the district health officer, not reaching the community. So we try to bypass that system so that the drugs reach the right people. About quality, I mean, this thing is affecting almost all the drugs. All the systems, the quality is poor. But, I mean, we need to act. People are getting infected. People are dying. So we need to stop these deaths. And we cannot wait until everything is in place. We have to start from somewhere to save them. It's time to deliver now.
The question about partners in health is a great question, Selena. And here's how I would put it. I think that if any of you want to actually see a Partners in Health project and talk to the nurses and doctors and community health workers that work there, what they'll tell you is that they feel terrible that they can't provide even more services than they're providing. I think, you know, and I've heard many people go and look at a Partners in Health project and say, oh, it's gold-plated. And I'm thinking, what kind of crazy world do we live in which basic, simple access to health services in pretty run-down facilities using minimal laboratory infrastructure is gold-plated for another human being? It's not gold-plated. It's an attempt at decency. And let me also say that when we started treating drug-resistant TB patients in Lima, Peru in 1995, they told us we were crazy, it was gold-plated, don't even think about it, you are being unrealistic and even dangerous. When we started treating HIV patients in Haiti with drugs that were donated to us, they told us we were crazy, this is bad. In fact, almost arguing that we were being unethical. And a person who now is a prominent person in HIV treatment scale-up once told me it was unethical to treat people living with HIV in Haiti.
So you can count on Partners in Health for one thing. First of all, without Partners in Health, we wouldn't have had the 3x5, because the entire 3x5 movement was based on my experience at Partners in Health. Two, you can always count on Partners in Health to try to push the boundaries of care. Because what we found is that what we thought was just bare minimum decent care and was called at the time gold-plated, people look back now and can't imagine ever having thought that that might have been gold-plated. We have to continue to push the boundaries of what we consider decency. And knowing that the entire community health worker movement that we're asking for can be supplied with 2 days of the war in Iraq, I will never, ever recommend to anyone that we try for a lower standard of care. We might not get there all at once. We have to pick out the pieces of the Partners Health model that can be applied today, what can be applied tomorrow, but shooting for something decent and dignified for every person on the face of the earth is always what Partners in Health will do, and I think it's a good strategy for at least some organizations to do that. Let's take two from number one, and then go back to number two.
I'm Robert Plitzman from Columbia University. For Dr. Kim and other panelists, I'm wondering what you think the biggest ethical questions you do face are, and relatedly, what the areas that you feel more behavioral social science research would be helpful. In other words, what don't we know? Also, I'm struck that there is funding for rollout, but not sort of doing that kind of research. I don't have any suggestions or thoughts about that.
Another one from one.
Yeah. My name is Peter Ayer. I'm from the Medical Mission Institute in Germany. Question actually for all of you. In the scaling up process, there is one aspect which I did not hear, and from some discussion I had in the beginning of this year, it could be a major problem. That's the capacity of the pharmaceutical industry. It seems that the capacity of the pharmaceutical industry to produce first-line, particularly first-line, but also maybe second-line drugs, is not as high as the scaling-up process is going, which might result in, let's say, if Malawi places an order with, just named Cipla, for so many drugs that it takes 4 months for Cipla to reduce. So the number second after you might have to wait, instead of 6 weeks, 4 months, and that other person might then run out of drugs in his own country. And I heard from several sources, including the pharmaceutical sources, that this is a big, big issue and hampering the scaling up. Please, your comments on that.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the previous round of questions. Yeah. Well, just one comment, not exactly related to a specific question, but I heard the plenary session with Mark Haywood this morning about 800 people dying a day in South Africa. To hear my colleague's presentation on the panel, it almost sounds like there's two different South Africas, where one is calling for the health minister to resign and talking about a terrible disaster, and the other South Africa is talking about this very impressive scale up. So I was also wondering if you would comment on the position of treatment action campaign. So it's a question. And to Jim, I just wanted to mention, I think it's really important. I'm a great supporter of Partners in Health, and I have known Paul Farmer for many years, and I support him. I think 3x5, it might have been your idea, but the concept in general was a product of the work of hundreds or 500 or thousands of activists, people living with AIDS, many of whom did not survive to see 3x5, and it wasn't Partners in Health as such. I just think it's really important to recognize that there's a worldwide movement with best practice examples, which includes MSF and Partners in Health and other government best practice movement.
Richard, thank you for that. I just want to let me clarify just quickly. We shorten what we say. I really apologize for that. What I meant was that if I hadn't had the experience with Partners in Health with scaling up, I wouldn't have personally felt the confidence in pushing forward on 3x5. That's all I meant. Okay. Great questions, but why don't we just take one more and then we'll answer them as a panel. Number two.
Yeah, my name is Kathy Noakes. I'm a nurse. I'm from New York City, which is the epicenter of the epidemic in the quote-unquote developed world. I was a Fulbright scholar in Durban, South Africa from January to July 2006. And so I have many, many impressions, but I have a few questions. Baccalaureate graduates from the University of KwaZulu-Natal can prescribe medications, but the physicians decided that they could not prescribe ARVs. In South Africa, you've got the option of 1A or 1B. You don't take 1B if you're childbearing. Almost anyone can figure out to give 1A. Why was the decision, and when you look at the slides, KwaZulu-Natal has the highest population according to Stats South Africa and the lowest percentage of people on ARVs. You talk about how easy the rollout is. I'd like to go back to the people in the Dream Center that I saw last year. 80 people in the Dream Center. 3 were on ARVs. They were dying, dying, dying. Nurses could have delivered 1A, but the physicians controlled that. So perhaps you could tell me why those policies were made and why is in KwaZulu-Natal the lowest number of people on ARVs.
Well, I guess the question, the comment from Richard and the last question are related. It was very hopeful of me to think that I could make a presentation which kind of steers away from the great controversy and conflict in South Africa. And, I don't feel kind of that obliged to kind of explain my own personal kind of position on this matter. Especially to someone who can't say KwaZulu-Natal. But the points that are being made by both people are that the scale up in South Africa and the way it's being managed are just completely unsatisfactory at the highest level, and there's no doubt about that. The number of mistakes that have taken place in the implementation of treatment in South Africa, it's nothing short of appalling. And there's no doubt about that. That point has been made. It's been made so many times, and, Mark and Sipo are here from the Treatment Action Campaign, and they make it well, and they made their point this morning. I was trying to get, just to go beyond that, to try to give a description of some of the healthcare issues in it. But if you want me to make a raving political speech, which I did every day for about 5 years in South Africa, if somebody can hand me a placard and a T-shirt, then I'm quite happy to do that. Now, the point is that there are hundreds of people dying from HIV in South Africa. There's no doubt about that. And, if you want me to kind of up the language on what it means to be aiming for reaching a 50% target. Now, that's no way to manage an epidemic like we have in South Africa. So I don't think that anyone must get the wrong impression that 250,000 people on treatment for South Africa, is anywhere near where it should be. And I think that the great tragedy is that South Africa has the finances, it has the capacity, it has the human resources more than any other neighboring country in the region to be able to reach universal access. And I guess, that discussion, in fact, what detracts from a lot of the policy issues in South Africa, which have to do about getting on with treatment, tackling the extremely difficult issues around how to get there, we've been completely distracted, and the whole of the country is in a cul-de-sac, between the minister on one hand and the rest of us on the other hand, and we must get beyond that. And I was just trying to do that, But I guess I wasn't successful.
Okay. Just to address some of the other quick questions, we just had a meeting on research questions for HIV, and the result of that meeting was very interesting. What we decided was that, there are lots of things that were being researched before that have become quickly irrelevant. For example, can Africans adhere to ARV therapy?
And in the process of just scaling up, we're finding that adherence rates are very high in a lot of places. I think the challenge is to move more toward a rapid scale, more of a quality improvement type system where we try to learn how to use very rapid methods of evaluation to improve what we're doing. The challenge is implementation. And as people prepare their research questions, what I think we're finding is that questions that we thought would, you know, stop all of us from doing anything have become quickly irrelevant as countries have scaled up. So the conclusion coming out of our meeting for the Doris Duke Foundation was that there's a range of research, longitudinal studies to look at the long-term economic impact of ARV therapy, for example. But we've really got to move toward the very short-term quality improvement type systems that will help us to implement on a day-to-day basis. So I think we're clear that we're going to recommend that we need more money for research, but not just, you know, the kind of controlled clinical trials, for example, that push forward people's academic careers. We're going to have to do the kinds of research that will actually help people in the field implement tomorrow. And in terms of the capacity of the pharmaceutical industry, I think it's entirely false that the generic industry or any other industry cannot make the drugs. What I saw in my experience at WHO, talking to leaders of the Indian pharmaceutical industry, talking to leaders of the Chinese pharmaceutical industry, is that they had absolutely, without question, tons of capacity to supply the entire world without any problem. The issue was that they were still worried about possible retaliations and problems with intellectual property. This is why I called for, I think we need to all sit at one table and begin aggressively moving forward to find a way to make all first and second line drugs immediately available. The production capacity is there without question. Let's take two questions from number one, and I think that's it. I'm sorry, Mandeep, no follow-ups.
No, it's a different, it's not a question.
But the people in the front have been waiting a lot longer. There's the two people in mic one, and then we have to quit.
Thank you very much. My name is Nicola Brennan. I work with Irish Aid. Just two questions. None of the presenters presented their data disaggregated by gender. And I think I'd like some comment from the panelists with respect to equitable access, both for men and women, to treatment, and also in particular for children, because that has been a key theme of this conference, has been pediatric access, and it is a key challenge. So I think it would be very useful to get comment on both of those. And then secondly, we've had this session on scaling up access to ART. We've had a separate session parallel on scaling up access to HIV treatment or prevention. We've had no session on scaling up access to care and support. It's been a very neglected component. And that's one point. And the second point is, how do we begin? We're trying to scale up access universally to prevention, treatment, care and support. What, according to the panelists, are the key strategies that we can employ to ensure that the limited resources that are available, actually we get the balance right across a comprehensive and integrated approach so that everybody can get access to the services and resources that they actually need, be it prevention, treatment or care. Thank you.
I'm just going to ask two practical questions, one about the Malawi program and one about the South Africa program. And the Malawi program is using Triimmune. What do you do with patients that have TB, and is it safe to use? Are you finding in program conditions that it's safe to use Triimmune with TB treatment containing rifampicin? And then the question about South Africa is, I noticed a lot more people in year four were going on to second-line therapy. One thing we don't really know is what's going to happen to those people who may have had a resistant virus for a long time. How are they going to do on the second-line therapy? So what's your sense in public health programs that aren't going to be using viral load to monitor people? You're switching them presumably because of clinical progression or CD4 or both. How are they doing once they're going on the second-line therapy, and how do you measure whether or not they're benefiting?
Okay. We did give you the data of patients so segregated by gender. But what we are seeing is in Malawi, 58% of the patients who are on ART are women, and 52% are men. And on children, it is only 5% of the children which are accessing ART. And there were reasons for that. You know, previously we are using adult preparations of Triimmune, And we got, at first it was not advisable to break thymine for children. So we were waiting for pharmacokinetic studies to prove that the breaking of the thymine is allowed in children, and the children who have adequate drug levels in their blood. This now has been regulated. Operational research was done, and now children are getting the split doses of thymine, and we expect that by the end of this year, probably this 5% will increase to 15%. About the TB thymine issue, at the moment we are running an operational research where patients who are on the ARVs and have got TB are starting concurrently, and the people are going to monitor the pharmacokinetic levels of nevirapine and rifampicin, whether they have enough therapeutic levels. But what is happening is for those patients who develop TB before starting ART, before starting thymine, they have to wait for the 2 months, the initial phase. Then after the initial phase, then they are started on thymine. But those ones who have started with the thymine and developed TB while they're already on thymine, we are not stopping thymine, we're just combining. And that's the advice which we got from WHO and the UNICEF, that you just better go ahead. It's better to combine than to stop.
I'm really sorry that I've got to notice that we've got to stop. Thank you very much for coming, and thanks especially to the panelists.